This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 7.4 billion people inhabit the planet. Most of the ones in Mogadishu, Edinburgh, and Asuncion probably don't care how the Chicago Cubs fare, and the ones who do are only paying attention to the World Series because they have money riding on it. But maybe all 7.4 billion should care. Certainly they should, if W.P. Kinsella's glimpse into the future was prophetic. Back in 1985, Kinsella, who died last month, published a book of short stories titled The Thrill of the Grass, and one of those stories has the fate of humanity hinging on whether the Cubs win the pennant. In Kinsella's tale, the Cubs are managed by baseball lifer Al Tiller. As Kinsella puts it, Tiller's only desire is to manage his baseball team in an honorable manner. But he's not destined to be left alone to do that. Al Tiller begins having dreams, and he doesn't know what to do about them, as Kinsella writes.
He could picture himself at a news conference, pausing right in the middle of fielding questions about his pitching rotation and his left fielder's Achilles tendon to say,
"Gentlemen, for the past several weeks, I've been having some prophetic dreams. It is my considered opinion that if the Chicago Cubs win the National League pennant, the world is going to end."
In fact, well, in fiction to be more precise, the first of Al Tiller's dreams is fairly pedestrian. Five people are arranged around a table, at the head of which sits an old man dressed in flowing robes of ice blue and flamingo pink. So, not all that pedestrian. Anyway, from a balcony above them, Al Tiller looks on.
"Please, God,"
says the man at the far end of the table,
"we'd like you to arrange for the Chicago Cubs to win the pennant this year."
Tiller wakes in the dark. Kinsella has the manager's heart
thumping like a bongo drum.
And no wonder. The dreams continue, and the people at the table become more insistent.
"It is time for the Chicago Cubs to win their division,"
one says.
"And the National League pennant,"
said a runty guy with a big nose who looked like someone he should know, Al Tiller thought.
"And the World Series,"
said a hefty, white-haired man who, Tiller decided, was Richard Daley, the man who was mayor of Chicago almost forever back in the 60s and 70s.
"We're not greedy, God,"
said the runty guy.
"Just help the Cubs with the National League pennant. We'll take our chances on the World Series."
On the sixth night of troubling dreams, the text takes a turn for the worse, a big, sharp, spooky turn, because it is on the sixth night that God seems to be attending to the requests.
Tiller was certain that Al Capone was one of the lobbyists that evening. He'd always thought of Capone as a White Sox fan.
When God spoke, he sounded to Al Tiller a little like a senator.
"I appreciate your interest. I want to assure you that I hold the Chicago Cubs in highest esteem. I have listened to your entreaties and considered the matter carefully from all angles. I am aware of how long it's been since the Cubs have won the pennant. I think you should know that when the Cubs next win the National League championship, it will be the last pennant before Armageddon."
Al Tiller wakes up,
sweat-soaked, heart-thrumming.
What is he to do? Armageddon? He'd never asked for that sort of responsibility. The closing weeks of the pennant race coincide with rising tensions between the U.S. and the Russians, each nation having decided it has significant interests to protect in Sri Lanka. Naval vessels from each prominent power are en route to the potential confrontation. We're talking Sri Lanka here, not Syria, but sweat-soaked and heart-thrumming yet? Meanwhile, Al Tiller either hears or imagines that he hears a sports call-in show in which one of the callers identifies himself as a blind archangel who says things like,
"The Chicago Cubs will win the last pennant before Armageddon."
And
"the prophecy speaks for itself."
Predictably, or perhaps prophetically, the pennant race gets closer.
Tense as a piano wire.
That's Kinsella again.
Tense as a piano wire.
Al Tiller waits for sleep.
But when sleep came, the dream came with it. Silvery as moonlight, like a tiny tornado of stardust floating in through the glass of the window and burrowing into Al Tiller's sleeping form. He knew immediately the dream was subtly changed, but it took him a few seconds to recognize how. The woman in the group was not a stranger. Tiller's heart dropped. His stomach rose until the two collided. When she spoke, he recognized the voice of his first love, and no angelic choir could have sounded sweeter.
"Please, God,"
she said,
"I would like the Chicago Cubs to win the pennant this year.
With the weight of the world's fate on his shoulders and the voice of the only woman he has ever loved in his ear, Al Tiller goes to the ballpark to manage the most important game of his life, of anybody's life. He is, as Kinsella puts it, prepared to suffer, which is suitably enigmatic for a story about a game that ain't over till it's over, don't you think? I'll not be revealing who comes out on top in what Al Tiller fears may be the last pennant race. That wouldn't be fair to W.P. Kinsella, even if I shouted, spoiler alert, before doing it. Read the story. And regarding Armageddon, hey, the Cubs won the 2016 National League pennant, and Armageddon didn't happen yet, though that business just this week about the warmer water swirling under the polar ice is disturbing, and the computer hacking may lead who knows where as far as the grid is concerned, and those wars, relatively small ones for now, rumble on. Yikes. We're grateful to W.P. Kinsella's literary agent, Carolyn Swayze, for permission to use portions of The Last Pennant Before Armageddon from the collection titled The Thrill of the Grass. We'll miss W.P. Kinsella, best known for writing Shoeless Joe, which begat the film Field of Dreams. Some stories are fictional, and some would seem to be, except that they're true. Here's Paul Guggenheimer of member station WESA in Pittsburgh.
The year was 1971, and the team was the Pittsburgh Pirates. I was a city kid who spent a lot of time playing sports on the cement playground at Fulton Elementary School in Pittsburgh's East End while idolizing many of the Pirates' players. But it was also a tense and confusing time. Busing had already begun. A lot of the white kids, including some of my friends, regarded the arrival of black kids with suspicion, and many of the black kids didn't particularly trust us. There were fights. But integration didn't seem to be a problem for the Pirates.
We were family, but we just didn't have the song to go along with it.
That's Al Oliver, one of my favorite Pirates players, and the song he's talking about is We Are Family by Sister Sledge. The song didn't come out until 1979, but there's a reason why it applies to the 1971 Pirates.
We were able to unite together with great cohesion, you know, with Latin players, with black players, with white players. We all came together, you know, for one common cause, and that was to bring a world championship back to Pittsburgh.
Most of the players in the Pirates' regular starting lineup were black, including, of course, Roberto Clemente, baseball's first Latin American superstar, and his fellow outfielder Willie Stargell, catcher Manny Sanguian, and infielder Dave Cash. On days when Doc Ellis pitched, at least half a dozen black players took the field at Three River Stadium, but I never really noticed. What I did notice about Al Oliver was that, like me, he was left-handed and played first base. He split time at the position with Bob Robertson, a righty.
We were a very unselfish team. When you weren't playing, you know, you pulled for the other guy who took your spot.
And that unselfishness was paying off. The Pirates were leading the National League East for most of that summer. And I, at that wonderful age of 11 going on 12, before girls or summer jobs became a distraction, made it to more games than I have in any other year of my life. The Buccos seemed destined to win a second consecutive division title, but slumped badly during August. Managers sometimes try unusual things when their team is in a free fall like that, and Pirate skipper Danny Murtaugh, a man with a dry wit who didn't mince words, often went with his ample gut. On September 1st, as Murtaugh filled out his lineup card for a home game against the Philadelphia Phillies, he decided to cast aside conventional baseball wisdom when it came to matching up right-handed hitters against left-handed pitchers.
He did what his heart led him to do. And when you allow your heart to lead you, normally things will turn out the right way.
Murtaugh would have usually started Bob Robertson at first against a left-handed pitcher like the Phillies' Woody Freeman. Instead, Oliver got the nod. But Robertson didn't spend a lot of time wondering why.
Well, when I went around the corner to look at the lineup, I looked at it, and then I knew what was happening here. It was a day of history, and I was fortunate enough to be there to see this.
What Robertson saw was Major League Baseball's first all-black starting lineup. Rennie Stennett was leading off, followed by Kleins, Clemente, Stargell, Sankey, Cash, Oliver, Jackie Hernandez at short, and Ellis on the mound. It had taken nearly a quarter century since Jackie Robinson broke the color line for this moment to happen. And yet, when the Pirates took the field, Al Oliver didn't even notice. At least not right away.
probably in the third or fourth inning is when I noticed it. And I asked Dave Cash, I said, Dave, we have all brothers out there. And he said, Ollie, he said, yes, we do.
Woody Freiman lasted just a third of an inning after allowing the Pirates five runs in the first. Then the Phillies rallied to take a 6-5 lead against an equally shaky Ellis. From the dugout, Robertson watched the Bucks bats come alive.
It was their moment, and they went out and won that ball game. So that was a time in history that you just said, amen.
The pregame hunch had paid off for Murtaugh, apparently oblivious to the history he'd helped make, telling the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, quote, "When it comes to making out the lineup, I'm colorblind, and my athletes know it." The next day, the Bulletin ran the headline, "Pirates starters all black." There were no such headlines in Pittsburgh because there was a newspaper strike. And that's pretty much all that was said about it for years. 6 weeks after it happened, the Pirates made it to the World Series and went on to defeat the heavily favored Baltimore Orioles in seven games. At a recent reunion marking the 45th anniversary of that championship, I met Oliver and Robertson for the first time. What struck me as I listened to them relive so much of the 71 season was how this aspect of their legacy, the all-black lineup, seemed to mean as much to them as winning a World Series. And they were asking the same question I was, that we all are still asking. Why did it take until 1971 for it to happen?
Far too late. This should have happened many years before 71. But I don't think the racial divide was as bad then as supposedly it is now. And I'm sure that that time it affected a lot of people to see all nine black players out there playing against another team. But as the Pirates, they played as one, being out there together as a unit. And maybe someday in this country of ours that we can get together as a unit.
As my friends and I watched the postseason unfold that fall, we could see ourselves in the Pirates, players who were from drastically different backgrounds, but got along, loved each other like brothers, and did something great. For Only a Game, I'm Paul Guggenheimer.
We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but before we get back to it, I'd like to thank Midsummer Adieu, who reviewed our podcast on iTunes. Ms. or Mr. Midsummer Adieu, if that really is your name, said, "I love everything about this show. Women are included as authorities on the panel, which is so important. Thank you." You're welcome. Consider joining Midsummer Adieu with a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. The New York Giants released kicker Josh Brown earlier this week. That decision followed the public release of documents in which Brown acknowledged that he'd abused his wife, and that is where we will begin this week's three stories that you should know. My guests this time around are Mina Kimes of ESPN and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports. Both join me via Skype. Welcome back.
Hello.
Always good to be here.
Mina, you have been thinking about the Giants' handling of the Josh Brown case. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so for those who have sort of missed the story over the summer, Josh Brown is a longtime NFL kicker who's played for several teams, including most recently the New York Giants. This summer, after signing a new contract, he was suspended for one game for violating the NFL's personal conduct policy. Not long after that, it was reported that his ex-wife, Molly, had told the police he had been violent with her on more than 20 occasions. Then, a few days ago, new documents emerged in which Brown directly confessed to abusing his wife, kicking off a firestorm that eventually led to the Giants releasing him. I've always had trouble wrapping my mind around these cases, because while the league is clearly incapable or perhaps unwilling to conduct thorough investigations, I, along with many football fans, especially female football fans, just don't like the idea of being forced to watch an alleged domestic abuser on the field. But I read this piece a few days ago by Diana Moskovitz in Deadspin, and it really changed my thinking. She wrote about how women like Molly Brown can be fearful of reporting abuse because they don't want to threaten their husbands' livelihoods. And she asked, quite convincingly, I thought, if these punishments could actually backfire on them. And after reading the piece, I found myself agreeing with her and wondering if we need to rework the entire process to prioritize the needs of victims, not necessarily fans like myself.
You know, I read the same piece, and I agree with a lot of it. It also changed my thinking a little bit, too. But it reinforced another piece of my thinking, which is I think the NFL and other sports leagues, too, they need to get out of the business of trying to police off-field conduct. The NFL is a football marketing company. It's not a police department. It's not a domestic violence investigator. It has no idea what it's doing when it wades into these waters. We've seen what happens when the NFL wades into science. It didn't do so well with concussions. It didn't do so well with deflated footballs. I'm not even sure it's great at marketing, by the way, at this point. And I just think these leagues would be better off letting law enforcement do its job and doing theirs.
I read the essay, the Moskowitz essay as well, and people can link to it at onlyagame.org. I think she does a fine job of establishing that victims of domestic violence suffer again when their husbands are deprived of the ability to earn a living. And the children also suffer when there's no money coming in, obviously. But on the other hand, people who are guilty of criminal assault need to be punished. Otherwise, what's the point of a law against criminal assault?
It is such a difficult issue. And I think, you know, I agree with both of you in that it does seem like these extrajudicial investigations, clearly, aside from being ineffective, you know, maybe shouldn't be happening.
I mean, it does feel like we are trying to, or these leagues are trying to please fans. To me, fans do have a choice. Like,
right.
You can turn off the TV. If you don't like the guy or the woman who is playing for the team who has got something going on in their non-sports life, you can boycott. That's always possible. You don't have to necessarily rely on a commissioner to do some sort of incomplete and incompetent investigation and then hand down some sort of arbitrary punishment.
Patrick, your longtime close friend, the NCAA, is at it once again. Tell us what your latest complaint against them is.
So glad you brought that up. They are my very good friends. And this week we saw the NCAA announce that it plans to distribute millions of dollars in its March Madness TV money to member schools, not only for winning basketball games, which it has always done, but now also for academic performance by athletes. So in other words, if your team hits certain academic benchmarks, your athletic department is going to get some extra cash. NCAA President Mark Emmert, also my good friend, said that the association is, quote, putting its money where its mission is. I say this is an empty gesture. Like, there's a way for the NCAA to say to the public, hey, look, we really care about school. All these great games you're watching, the ones that are making billions of dollars, they're really just about education. Oh, and by the way, federal antitrust court judges, please don't take away our tax exemptions. And God forbid, please don't make us share any more money with the athletes on the court. Here's how you know this is hollow. This is supposedly an attempt to financially incentivize better performance in the classroom. But the overwhelming number of financial incentives in college sports still attach to winning games. That's how you get paid if you're a coach. That's how you keep your job if you're an athletic director. That's how you get on TV and get paid under the table or make it to the NBA if you're a player. None of us are tuning in to watch all of these wonderful basketball players go to science lab. It's going to incentivize cheating. Schools are going to have even more reason now to create paper classes. One more thing I want to point out here. Usually when you want people to do something, you pay them for it. But in this case, the NCAA is basically saying to its athletes, hey, go work harder in the classroom, and we're going to give your bosses a bonus. Maybe instead of not paying athletes to play, which is what we do under amateurism, the NCAA should pay them to study. Now, of course, that would require people like Mark Emmert to do something crazy, and that's to actually put their money where their mission is.
I agree completely with Patrick. And I'm reminded of, you know, these academic bonuses that coaches have been getting for years. You know, UNC basketball was praised in the mid-2000s for tying Roy Williams' salary to the academics, and I think we all know how that worked out.
You know, we got a situation where there are more and more adjunct faculty that colleges and universities are depending on because they don't have to pay their health care costs and because they can fire them anytime they want. They don't have tenure. And so somebody, an assistant coach, comes up to one of these adjunct faculty and says, by the way, that 6'7", 300-pound guy who shows up every once in a while in class, how about if he gets a B instead of an F? Well, I'm trying to make the rent, so yeah, that might work if I got a little, you know, sugar on the side. This is going to be more corrupt than the current system, and I wouldn't have believed that was possible, but I think it is.
We're going to start seeing cash handshakes not for the athletes, but for the academic advisors, for the adjuncts, for the tutors. That would be incredible. I don't know. I might be in favor of that.
All right. I want to talk about some allegations coming out of the National Football League. In Jeff Perlman's new book about quarterback Brett Favre, Artis Hicks, who used to play for the Minnesota Vikings, claims that 8 years ago, the Vikings had a bounty system, and that will ring some bells because the New Orleans Saints, of course, were accused of having a bounty system. And anyway, Hicks says, yeah, I had coaches. They would start a pot. The veterans would each toss in $100, $200. And if you hurt somebody special, you got the money. Do we pay any attention to this because it happened some number of years ago? Or do we pay any attention to it because, yeah, everybody knows players go out to hurt each other in the NFL because that's how you win football games, by knocking out the other team's best players? Or is this a reason for the NFL to once again constitute a committee and have an investigation and come to some conclusions? I'm curious, should the league look away or what here?
As far as the league goes, I will tell you that they probably want nothing to do with this. It's hard to weigh the accuracy of the claims because I don't know how they reported or if multiple people have corroborated. But I will say it confirms something that I've long believed about the NFL, which is that when it comes to these scandals, if one team is doing it, many teams are doing it.
I mean, I think Mia's right. This is it's literally old news, but it's also sort of metaphorically old news in that, like, I think almost anyone that pays attention to football knows, A, that football is a violent game. B, the players are being paid to inflict violence on each other. And C, if they're doing it in form with each other, that flows from A and B. So, like I said, it's not really surprising. I'm not even sure most fans would consider it scandalous. The league itself, they're not where they were during Bountygate. You know, they've got their concussion settlement almost all wrapped up. They've really blown almost all their public credibility at this point, between the Tom Brady stuff, the Ray Rice stuff, the concussion stuff. I mean, nobody really looks at the NFL anymore and thinks moral arbiter. They generally think, you know, greedy, evil, sociopathic corporation like all the rest of them. So I'm not sure the NFL has to go scrambling around to investigate, you know, this 8-year-old bounty scandal that may or may not actually have happened. I think everyone's kind of just moved on and made their peace with sort of the NFL as a moral entertainment / violence machine.
Yeah. Well, just to finish this up, my favorite comment that came out of this story was somebody defending the Vikings. And he said, quote, "We have incentives for big plays, not injuries." And I'm just curious about how often big plays and injuries to important players overlap. I'd like to see the Venn diagram of that one. My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Mina Kimes of ESPN and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Always fun.
Once upon a time, there was a little boy who got to be star of the week in his elementary school classroom. He was excited. Who wouldn't be? The star of the week got to take attendance, hand out the treats at snack time, and present his favorite stuff at show and tell. But when the big day came, the little boy, who loved to play basketball, found to his dismay that being star of the week wasn't as much fun as he thought it would be, especially when it came to standing in front of the class and taking attendance.
As the week went on, little Shaq tried his best to be a good star, but he wasn't getting better.
The voice of that narrator, I know I've heard it somewhere, on TV maybe, I'm not sure.
My name is Dr. Shaquille O'Neal. I'm a television analyst. I'm a businessman. I'm a philanthropist. And I'm a master at being a nice guy.
Right, right. Hall of Famer, no stranger to the concept of Star of the Week. But he's also an author of children's books. And when he sat down to talk with me, he was hungry.
This muffin is awesome.
I like muffins, too. Sometimes they're even awesome. So we have that in common. The 44-year-old Shaq can afford as many muffins as he'd like, and he can do just about anything he wants to do these days. So what makes a man with 4 NBA championship rings and nearly $300 million in career earnings, not including endorsement income, decide to write children's books? The answer can be found in Shaq's childhood.
I had a stuttering problem because, me being the size that I am, people always expected me to be great. In my mind, I was never that great.
It may be hard now to imagine Shaquille O'Neal, that effervescent NBA 7-footer, with a lack of self-esteem. But when he was a youngster, he feared public speaking, struggled with some of his schoolwork, and had trouble reading. He got help, a lot of it.
Miss Swan, she was my 4th grade teacher in Hinesville, Georgia, Horace Mann Elementary School. And she used to sit and read all the time. You know, she would give us homework, and I'd be like, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't read it. She was like, okay, come back after school. And she would help me read it. And she just passed away. Miss Ann Swan, my fourth grade teacher, my favorite teacher ever.
So that's where Shaq got his love of reading, but that didn't immediately lead him to spend all his spare time in the library.
I was a medium-level juvenile delinquent. As a youngster, for me, I was definitely a follower. You know, the things I were doing as a juvenile, just simple stuff, stealing cars, stealing stuff out the store, just really very silly stuff.
Then a different champion stepped in to help Shaq.
My mother told me one day that if you want to become this big basketball star like your favorite guy, Dr. J, at some point in your life, son, you're going to have to start being a responsible model citizen, a role model slash real model.
That didn't happen right away. Maybe that's because Shaq was moving around too much. He was a member of a military family. After stops in Georgia, Germany, and Texas, Shaquille O'Neal arrived at Louisiana State University as one of the most highly recruited high schoolers ever. He was a two-time All-American as a sophomore, but he still hadn't overcome his stuttering problem. Enter LSU head coach Dale Brown.
I had a speech class that was mandatory, and we had to give a speech. I was terrified, so I called Coach Brown in the middle of the night, and he made me practice it in front of him 100 times. And then next day, I had confidence, you know, and I just went and I nailed the speech, and I was like, oh, I didn't know it was this easy. That I could have closed my eyes and not looked at anyone in the audience and still deliver that great speech.
O'Neal runs the floor, takes it all the way!
Before he would go on to become NBA Rookie of the Year, a 15-time All-Star, and 4-time NBA champion, Shaq made it clear that he wanted to be a different kind of public figure.
I said to my people that were representing me, I want to be known as the ambassador of fun, the overlord of fun, the emperor of fun.
He did that by becoming one of the most quotable and quoted athletes of his time. He showed up at kids' parties as Shaq-a-Bunny.
A lot of kids love the bunnies.
Yeah, yeah. He rapped and acted. He pitched products on television and always tried to make people laugh, and he would become a family man.
I have 6 children. You know, I used to read to my kids all the time. Actually, 3 of my kids would not go to sleep unless I pick up some sort of book and read it to them. And, you know, a lot of times I go visit kids in hospitals. I read to them. I go to school programs and read to them. And I just wanted to, you know, give them stuff that they could relate to.
In 1999, the ambassador of fun decided to write his first children's book, Shaq and the Beanstalk and Other Very Tall Tales, even as he was dominating the NBA.
So I wrote it. This was 15 years ago when my children were very young. And it was very difficult because, you know, being out of school so long, you know, you forget the run-on sentences and where to place the commas and, you know, simple stuff like that.
O'Neal retired from the court in 2011 and soon had the idea for a series of books featuring, well, who else could it possibly be?
Suddenly, little Shaq remembered the voice of his favorite basketball announcer. It was loud and clear, and it always got his attention. If little Shaq could sound like him, his class might listen. Little Shaq cleared his throat. Douglas Alvarez, he said in the best announcer voice. Doug responded right away. Little Shaq tried the voice again. Susie Carmichael. Here, said Susie. It was working.
Okay, I want to know if you had a particular basketball announcer in mind when you had little Shaq go into his basketball announcer voice so people would pay attention.
Marv Albert.
Yes!
Everybody loved Marv's voice.
Okay, so little Shaq exercises the demons of stuttering and self-consciousness by imitating his favorite announcer. But what about the struggles bigger Shaq had with delinquency? Shaquille O'Neal says that there's a link between taking responsibility when you're young and avoiding trouble when you're older. He writes about those things, and he gets to have fun with cat sounds.
Everyone, said little Shaq, this is my cat, Tiger. That evening, little Shaq watched TV with his brother, sister, and brand new kitten. Meow.
A quick check with Amazon earlier this week indicated that O'Neal's latest book, Little Shaq, Star of the Week, had ascended to number 30 among books/children's books/sports and outdoors/basketball. But while numbers mattered a lot to the author before he became an author, that is, when he was still a basketball player, piling up points and rebounds, they're not so important now.
I don't measure success all the time by the number of books sold or hitting the bestsellers list. I've seen a lot of kids, Uncle Shaq, Grandpa Shaq, I read your book. Mommy, that's the guy from the bookstore. Matter of fact, after this, I'm going to my youngest daughter's school to read. So that, to me, is success.
And that, to me, is a very fine reason to end the conversation. Shaquille O'Neal is going to read to his daughter and her classmates, and I don't want to be the reason he's late. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Coming up on Only a Game, former NFLer Jarvis Green turns his attention from the gridiron to the bountiful ocean.
I used to play football in the NFL. Won my two Super Bowls. I never thought I'd be learning price points, understanding what it costs to get a shrimp out of the water.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, high school football flourishes in the once-thriving steel town of Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Going into Friday's Game 3 of the World Series, the median ticket price at Wrigley Field was about $3,000, $2,500 for standing room. Do you think that's a little too much, even to see possible history being made courtesy of the Cubs and Indians?
Well, I mean, yes, but I'm not a Cubs fan, so I can't get myself into that mentality. I would point out it is roughly the same price as a really good funeral.
Major League Baseball worries about not having younger fans. They're restricting themselves to younger fans who have $3,000 to spend on a game.
That's really quite interesting, and it's too bad, too, because this series is a terrific advertisement for Major League Baseball.
What do you make of Cleveland manager Terry Francona's innovative three-man starting pitching rotation of Kluber, Bauer, and Tomlin?
Well, if you can get Kluber two or possibly three starts in a seven-game series, you're a genius. And Terry Francona has already proven in a couple of different places that he knows how to manage a ball club. I'm very, very impressed by this.
The NBA regular season got underway this week. Last year, the Golden State Warriors were very good. In fact, they set the NBA record for regular season wins. This year, they began the season by losing by 29 points to San Antonio. So, time to write the Warriors off?
No, but it is time to point out that the San Antonio Spurs, under Greg Popovich, are going to be pains in the neck in the NBA forever. I've decided that.
Las Vegas has said that the New York Knicks are the popular long shot bet among folks inclined to try picking the next NBA champ. Is there anything that suggests to you why the Knicks would be anybody's pick to be NBA champion, even as a long shot?
Well, because I think a lot of people from New York go to Las Vegas to gamble.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe some sort of discount flights from New York to Las Vegas over the past
week.
Yeah,
I would look on the Southwest Airlines manifest, basically, to find out why.
On Wednesday, singer Seven Streeter was scheduled to perform the national anthem before a 76ers game in Philadelphia, and she says the team told her she could not sing because she was wearing a jersey that said "We Matter" on it. According to one reporter, contract prohibited political statements. Do you think the words "We Matter" on a shirt constitutes a political statement?
Well, yeah, I do, and I think it's something that they should allow. I don't think there's any question that it's political. Everybody knows it's political. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows the context. But I think the NBA and its attendant franchises have better lighten up on this issue because there are going to be a lot of these this year.
Charlie, there's a lot of crazy stuff swirling around the Minnesota Vikings this week. First, there were reports that the team had a bounty system back in 2008-2009 under former head coach Brad Childress. And now there have been allegations that the current head coach, Mike Zimmer, has slaughtered stuffed animals to motivate his team. How do you slaughter a stuffed animal?
Well, I mean, the evolution of the football coach is slow, but it is steady, and it does bend towards sensibility, because you'll remember that a few years ago, we had the college coach down south who did something terrible to a bull in front of his team.
Yes.
So if we've moved on to stuffed animals, you know, the levels of sociopathy in the average football coach are starting to move toward basic humanity.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what comes next? Menacing cartoon characters?
That's a very good point.
This week, Tom Brady disappointed any teams that were hoping that he would one day become their coach. He said he doesn't have the patience to be a coach. You wrote a book about the guy. Does this self-assessment ring true?
Absolutely. They're still at his parents' house. There's still a hole in the wall where he threw a video game controller through it because he lost. If he does go into coaching, it's going to be at a very low level where he can sort of put this incredible drive he has on hold. What he does after football is going to be very interesting. I think it's very close to even money that he just disappears for a while.
Kentucky men's basketball coach John Calipari has written a book, or at least he's put his name on the front of one, and it's titled Success is the Only Option. And when advised that Rick Pitino, the men's basketball coach at Louisville, had once written or put his name on the front of a book titled Success is a Choice, Calipari said, I don't care. And if he doesn't, neither do I. And how about you?
No, I don't care at all. I'm waiting for some college basketball coach to write a book saying success means buying players.
Yeah, well, you got a long wait, I'm afraid. Finally, Charlie, Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman showed up at a press conference on Wednesday wearing a Harry Potter costume, and he told the folks, I'm definitely a wizard. So I guess he's a wizard.
I mean, what did they do? Did they put the sorting helmet on his head?
I don't know, but it is a blow against the No Fun League if there ever was one.
I'm surprised that Richard Sherman hasn't been fined $11 million by now.
Sherman was highly critical of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell this week, so I guess he finally will be able perhaps to vanquish the evil Lord Godelamort.
Oh, we're stumbling over our Harry Potter references. I'm just afraid that the evil wizard will make Richard disappear for a couple of weeks.
There's precedent. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
You would think that reaching the highest level in professional sports would be something an athlete would want to be known for, something he might want to put on his business card or his gravestone when the time came around. But our next story is about an athlete who struggled his whole life with being known only as an athlete, and he's finally found a way to be known as something else, an entrepreneur. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
The first thing Jarvis Green wants to know as we sit across the table from each other in the faculty cafeteria at Babson College is which of the many nearby schools that start with the letter B houses my radio station. Oh, Boston University, he says. I'm trying to do something with Boston University. The next thing I know, we're talking about Green's plans to sell pre-cooked shrimp to college students with value-added sauce packets so they can't mess it up. And if those aren't phrases you'd expect to hear from a former defensive end, you're not alone.
I used to play football in the NFL. Won my two Super Bowls. I never thought I'll be doing this, you know, learning price points, understanding what it costs to get a shrimp out of the water.
Jarvis Green isn't in the shrimp business because he needs the money. Sure, he could use more. He says we all could. Jarvis Green is in the shrimp business because, well, let's start at the beginning. Unlike most NFL players, Green didn't start playing football until the seventh grade.
I wasn't a kid to say I was going to be an NFL football player. Never played Little League football, Pop Warner, whatever you want to call it. I was small, man. I was seventh grade. I was probably 5'7". I had no muscle on me, just all bones and skin.
On the first day of practice, the coach told Green to tackle his older cousin, who was twice his size. The hit was so hard that Green's helmet spun around on his head. He found himself looking out through the earpiece.
I'm like, this can't be for real. I'm going to knock the bejesus out of me. Coach said, hey, Green, that being a punk, get up there and do it again. Did it, almost fought my mouthpiece the second time. Looked around, took my helmet off, said I quit. Great old Coach Rabelais, you know, rest his soul. He passed away a few years ago. He followed me and was behind me, like screaming at me. And then he said, hey, what if I call your mom or your dad and your brothers? They was all playing college football, my brothers. What if I call them and say, you quit? You was a quitter. Oh, man, my older brothers are my heroes. I don't want them to hear this. I put my helmet back on, went back out there. That was the last time I quit anything.
Green didn't quit when his parents got divorced and he had to work to help his mom pay the electric bill. He says for weeks at a time, they were taking cold showers and walking around by candlelight. He didn't quit when he was sidelined by a serious back injury while playing football at LSU. And he didn't quit when his academic load got tough.
I hated being labeled just the football player. That always burned me, always. Oh, just a jock. So no, I'm not. I go to class like you. You know, and I went and picked a hard major. So I went to school for construction, management, engineering. And everybody said, oh man, you're gonna change that 5-6 times. I said, no, I'm not. I'm gonna graduate as an engineer, as a student, engineering.
In between studying for those engineering classes and attending practices and workouts, Green did something else that was pretty unusual for a football player. Thing is, while growing up in Louisiana, he had watched his mom and his grandma and his aunties in the kitchen. And when his teammates got hungry in the off-season, when the university wasn't allowed to feed them, he'd cook up huge stock pots filled with spaghetti and red beans, potato stew, shrimp stew, and jambalaya.
I had an open door policy. I said, make sure you shut the door, don't lock it. When you eat, whatever bowl, plate you use, clean it. And then when I come home, what they got left, I put it in the refrigerator. You know, and
but
after that.
You weren't even there. It wasn't even like everybody's hanging out.
Right. Open the door. Boom.
Green got his engineering degree from LSU and was a fourth round draft pick in 2002. He joined the New England Patriots and he made plenty of money. But he always had a job or two or three on the side.
My first 2 years, I thought I was going to get cut every day, every single day. I had to have a plan B, C, D. I worked on my days off during the season at Rolls Royce. People thought I was crazy. Just say, hey, man, concentrate. You're here. This is what you're doing. I understand, but I retired when I was 31. I was a kid. I have something to prove to myself.
What do you have to prove to yourself?
And I could build a business from nothing.
Could you not have picked something easier?
I could have.
When he retired from football in 2009, Green was not lacking in opportunities. ESPN invited him to Bristol, Connecticut for a boot camp to test his skills as a football commentator.
I said I didn't want to do that. It was the same thing. Got the old violin, you're playing the violin. Put me to sleep. Just didn't want to do it. Opportunity as a coach. You know, start off low level, earn it. No, I don't want to do that, man. I'm done with football. What you want to do? I want to go against the grain.
So that brings us back to how a defensive end ended up in the shrimp business. And let's get one thing out of the way right now. Green knows the baggage that comes with being a black man from the South who chooses to sell shrimp for a living.
Anyway, like I was saying, shrimp is the fruit of the sea. You can barbecue it, boil it, broil it, bake it, saute it. There's shrimp kebabs, shrimp Creole.
So just in case you didn't see the movie that won the 1995 Oscar for Best Picture, Forrest Gump, played by Tom Hanks, enlists in the Army, where he meets Benjamin Buford Blue, a.k.a. Bubba. And Bubba really likes shrimp.
Shrimp burger, shrimp sandwich. That's about it.
Forrest and Bubba make a plan to go into the shrimp business together, but they're ambushed in the jungle in Vietnam. Bubba tells Forrest to run, Forrest, run, and by the time Forrest comes back, it's too late to save Bubba. After the war, Forrest buys a shrimp boat, and as with everything else he does, he's pretty successful.
My little thing is, don't call me Bubba. People laugh. Ha 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 ha. Oh, I'm a black guy? Bubba. No. Bubba died. Guess who owed the favor to him? Tom Hanks. That's me. Owe somebody a favor. So I got into the shrimp business.
Green says he can't really get into that favor. He'll only say that he owed it to an old family friend, a Vietnamese man with a connection to a large Vietnamese shrimp co-op that needed some help.
I said, doing what? I said, selling shrimp. I said, okay. I know what shrimp tastes like. I said, man, I don't know anything about shrimp, though. I don't want to sell in Louisiana. People sell shrimp on side the road. No, once you go back to Boston, where you play ball at, I say, oh, good idea. Went home, told my kid's mom, hey, somebody want me to help them with the shrimp business? And the first thing she said, oh, thank you, Bubba Gump. She just laughed.
You probably know by now that it's going to take a lot more than that to make Jarvis Green quit at something.
Started doing it, worked for free for 6 months. When I started, they gave me a broom and a mop. And I started cleaning out, you know, bathrooms, kitchens, the plant. And just learned, went down the line. Peeled shrimp, deveined shrimp, dehead shrimp. I've been on my share of the shrimp boats. Just wanted to experience it. So I could tell somebody if something went wrong, I could tell them why it went wrong in the supply chain.
As part of his sales pitch, Green gives cooking demonstrations, using everything his mother taught him and all the skills he'd perfected cooking for his teammates at LSU. When he first started out, he didn't tell prospective clients that he had played football at LSU or anywhere else.
I never said who I was. My name was Mr. Green. I sell wild-caught Gulf domestic shrimp. I had my meeting with Stop and Shop in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Same thing. I am Jarvis Green, trying to sell some wild-caught Gulf shrimp. And I'm sitting down and talking to people, and they said, man, you're a big guy. You said, you ever played sports before? I said, yeah. I said, for who? I played up in the Boston area. He said, who, for BC, Boston College? I said, no, the Patriots. He said, what? Why didn't you say that in the beginning? That's how I was trying to sell the shrimp, the product, not me.
In 2015, Green started Oceans 97, his own company. Now he's knocking on the back doors of restaurants and meeting with universities for a business he built from scratch. He says he's not the biggest seafood company out there, which is fine. He doesn't want to rule the world. He just wants a small piece.
The day they read my eulogy, they're going to say at the end, oh, yeah, I forgot. He played professional football as well. 10 years from now, I'm going to be selling shrimp. I love it. And when I start talking about it, the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I start shaking. And I remember somebody saying, man, that's what you're supposed to be doing.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Thanks to the Only a Game Wrigley readers, Jack Lepiarz, Fred Tice, Bob Schaefer, Kirsten Kalkers, Jamie Bologna, Alex Ashlock, Erica Lands, Dave Faniff, and the very convincing Kelvin Brooks. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Shaquille O'Neal, who sings a classic from, about 35 years ago.
8765309. I hear a little echo.
Shaq, Jenny's number in the Tommy Two Tone hit song was 8675309, not 876. I don't know who you'd get if you dialed 876. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.